Hello, I'm Kerry Levy, and this is Gonservation Conversations, the show that sometimes finds it difficult to say its own name, but apparently not today. Well, joining me is Mark Riley, Six Music presenter, musician, all-round top bloke, and huge fan of whales and other cetaceans, which is one of the reasons why he's here. Hello, Mark. How the hell are you?
Kerry, I am fine, mate. I'm all the better for talking to you quite patently.
Oh, well, that's always good to know.
Actually, now, you see, sorry, mate, I really need to stop you there because you describe me as a musician and I like to think of myself more as a failed musician.
Oh, well, then that means I am your equal because I'm failed too. But I think you're more successful as a failure, if you know what I mean, or a lesser failure and more successful. I get confused when we deal with levels of fail.
Well, I'm happy with what you're describing me at the moment. So long as you keep the failure in there, I can live with it.
Okay, well, that's good. We've managed to find some common ground that we can bond over. And other things we could bond over is your love of whales. Now, is it just whales or is it other cetaceans too?
Do you know, it's wildlife, really. I mean, it's much broader than that. But the kind of interest in whale watching just happened by accident. I mean, every kid, I think, who's interested in wildlife in any way, shape or form has got to be fascinated with whales. And growing up, you would have seen Moby Dick and, you know, these magical creatures of the sea that you never really expect to be able to see. But it was a Riley family holiday to Tenerife, I would imagine, around about 20 years ago. And we were just walking through the seafront and it just had this little blackboard and it said, come and see the whales. So I'm like, wow, what does that mean then? Didn't know anything about it, didn't know anything about the whale population off the coast of Tenerife. And so I just said, right, let's go out on a boat. It was glorious. It was so beautiful. The boat was tiny because the whole kind of industry hadn't geared up at that point. And so we went out on the boat and we were just surrounded immediately by dolphins, bottlenose dolphins and pilot whales. And of course, pilot whales aren't whales, they're dolphins. But at that point in time, I didn't know anything about cetaceans, really. I had no knowledge of what pilot whales were. I thought they were whales because of that's in the name. And I was kind of hooked from that point onwards. And I remember we came home from there and it would have been a winter holiday, like probably in February, I would imagine, maybe March. And I immediately started looking for the holiday that we were going to go on the following year. So I started just Googling whale watching, and somewhere that came up was Cape Cod. And so I booked a holiday at Cape Cod and I booked the whale watching trip first. And what I didn't realise was it was going to be the very first whale watching trip of the season. And I do remember it's called Captain John's Whale Watching from Plymouth. And we went out into the ocean and we were just again immediately surrounded by humpback whales going under the boat. They were tail slapping. It was just magical. I couldn't believe it. And of course, the worst thing about that scenario is the fact that you just get fooled into believing that every time you go out on a boat, you're going to see loads of whales and it's going to be sunny and everything will be well in the world. But the more you do it, the more you realise that you can't really book appointments with these creatures. But you know, you've got to be in it to win it, as you say. And so it's something that I've kept on doing ever since then.
What really intrigues me is that you got into nature at an age when most people have given up on it. If they haven't stuck with it since when they were a kid, they pack it in until they get older in life.
Well, I mean, it is true to say that I was kind of obsessed with wildlife, particularly snakes and lizards as a kid growing up. And we used to have a grass snake, actually, me and Steve Hanley. And my mum wouldn't let me keep it in the house because she was petrified of snakes. And so we kept it at Steve's house and it was called Grasso, which is a really good name for a grass snake, don't you think?
I love it. I think it's fantastic. Perhaps you could explain who Steve Hanley is to our listeners.
Okay, so Steve Hanley is my oldest friend. I've known Steve Hanley since I was 6 years old. And we just hang out together all the time. And we went to primary school together, though Steve's a couple of years older than me. And we were just absolutely inseparable. And at the age of 16, I formed a band with Steve Hanley and another mate, Craig Scanlon. And around about a year after us forming, maybe a little bit less, I was invited to join The Fall, still age 16. And Steve and Craig continued to be in the band that we were in previously. It kind of morphed into another thing. And then a year later, Steve and Craig also joined The Fall. And still, they're like family, really, the Hanleys. Paul and Steve and Andrew and Harry. So both Paul and Steve were in The Fall. And they're my brothers, you know, they are family. And so, I spent more time at the Hanleys' house on my own, probably, growing up as a kid. And I used to keep my bike there because my mum and dad wouldn't let me have a bike. Not because they were cruel, just they didn't want me getting knocked off it. And I had to keep the snake there as well because my mum didn't like it. So that's why, probably. It was pretty much my second home, you know, or first home even.
While you were playing in bands, while you were in The Fall, were you still interested in wildlife or did that disappear to the side for a while?
Yeah, it did disappear, really. I've had dogs all my life, and that's been a common thread right through my whole life, actually. But no, I mean, to be honest, most of the time I didn't have any money to do anything. When I was in The Fall, we went to Iceland. So we were one of the very few bands to go to Iceland. I think we were probably like the third band to go there or something ridiculous like that, you know, in that era. I think Killing Joke had been, and maybe the Stranglers and the Clash, but it certainly wasn't on the circuit, you know. And of course, there was no ecotourism at that point in time in Iceland. So, and there was hardly any daylight. And I didn't really know that the whales existed as such, despite the fact that obviously whaling was probably in its height around that time in the early 80s. But again, yeah, we barely had enough money to buy beer. So you've got to get your priorities right. So no, and we'd go to Australia. We'd go to various places where it probably would have been possible to do something interesting if you had the weight in your pockets, but we didn't. I do remember, though, when we went to America, I was always intrigued in trying to find snakes, and I remember when The Fall were in Dallas, actually, I went looking for snakes, and I picked up this big rock and turned it over, and about 12 snakes jumped out, and I absolutely shit myself, pardon the phrase. And I did recognise them as garter snakes. I did know what they were, and they aren't poisonous. But still, all of these snakes running around my feet, it freaked me out a little bit. And I would always be looking out for animals as we were travelling across America. So I still had it in me a little bit, but like I say, I didn't have the finances to kind of pursue any of it, really.
Everyone always seems to think that you're going to see the world when you're travelling with a band, but the truth is you're stuck in a tour bus most of the time, and it's really hard to do anything non-musical.
Well, I tell you, what is strange, and I like this story, we were travelling from Sydney to Melbourne, and the band was The Fall, notoriously kind of understated or miserable, if you like. And we were travelling all together in a minibus, and we had an Australian driver come tour manager. And we're driving along, and I'm looking out the window, and I see a mob of about, I don't know, maybe 30 kangaroos bounding about, running alongside the side of the van. And I just thought to myself, kangaroos? Yeah, that's good. Well, the next second, the Australian driver, puts his brakes on, we all screech to a stop, and he shouts out, "Flipping heck, kangaroos!" So he'd never seen them, and he was more impressed about seeing the kangaroos than we openly were. I mean, like I say, I was like, oh yeah, it's Australia, kangaroos, they must see them all the time. But no, this guy had never seen a kangaroo in his life. So that gives you a little kind of snapshot into the environment within The Fall as well, probably. There's some photos of us at some wildlife sanctuary, which sounds a bit unlikely, but there are koala bears there. So we ticked off both of the... If only we got a duck-billed platypus, we would have got the full set, actually. We had experience with kangaroos and koalas, but not duck-billed platypus.
I love those unexpected moments with nature. That's the joy of wildlife. I remember walking in Spain and I was going up an old riverbed, and I noticed something by my ankle. And I looked down and it was a woodcock. It was just standing stock still and it had its eyes shut, obviously thinking, oh, if I have my eyes shut, he won't notice me. Well, I did notice him, but very quietly took a nice photograph of him and carried on my way. And when I looked back, he was still there, still with his eyes shut, but he was safe. And I love that. It's just incredible. You just get such a connection with the creature. Okay, look, we should move on, and I want to take you to Iceland, because that's been one of your go-to places, hasn't it?
Yeah, so it was 1982, I think, that we went with the fall, and there was no eco-tourism at that point in time, and yeah, it was just a very, very strange place. You know, you landed, I remember landing when we were at the airport, and with all the lava fields and everything, and it just looked like the moon. And of course, there wasn't much daylight. I think there's probably about 4 hours daylight. And there was all these strange cultural traditions, like no TV after 5 o'clock in the evening or something crazy. And also the weirdest thing was actually that there was no beer. You couldn't buy beer, but they sold spirits, which meant that everybody was just completely off their heads on whiskey and various other spirits. You couldn't just sit down and have a civilised pint. So culturally, it was so different, but amazing. And we had a great time there. We went to a recording studio that was built in a lava kind of flow. And so, yeah, it was probably, I would say, maybe 30 years later that I went with a friend of mine, Mark Carwardine, who is, anybody who's interested in wildlife, it's a good chance that you've heard of Mark Carwardine. He's such a brilliant fella. He's my hero, really. And he, I got to know him, actually, because he had a column in the BBC magazine, which we used to get when we worked on BBC North on Oxford Road in Manchester. And so I'd read this column by Mark Carwardine, and there'd be invariably things about whales in there. And so I just sent him an email. I found him in the system, and I said, you know, forgive me, it's a bit of an intrusion, but I want to go whale watching, and I want some advice, and we're thinking of going to Mull. And he got back, and he was brilliant. He said, yeah, and I know who you are, and I listen to you on the radio, and it's a pleasure to help you out, and gave me some great advice. And we went, and we did see whales there. And then it wasn't so long after that that Mark got in touch with me about a trip to Norway, which we can discuss later if you like. But then a little bit further down the line, he said, right, I'm going to Iceland. Are you coming? Yes. He started the whale watching scenario in Iceland. The very first whale watching trip that he sorted out in Reykjavik, they went out on the boat. And it was more press. It was more of a press junket, really. It wasn't no tourists involved, but it was the first one saying, look, whale watching is a thing and it's going to take off and we're going to continue to do it. And as they were going out of the harbour, all of the whalers, the gunboats, which are really ominously are right alongside the whale watching boats in Reykjavik. It's a disgusting thing. It's horrible. It really is upsetting to see all of the harpoons and everything. It's just the pits. But as they were going out to sea to show the press of the world that there are whales out here and it's a great thing to do and the brilliant things to see, all of the whaling boats came along beside them laughing and waving at them, you know, like what they were, this undertaking was the biggest folly known to man ever. Of course, you look down the line now, all these years later, and you know, whale watching is a billion, multi-billion pound operation that just, you know, is invaluable and one of the best things that you could ever do. So, yeah, that was it, really. We went out whale watching, we saw whales, we had a great time. And so I've been back. Yeah, I think I've been to Iceland probably about 10 times now. They also have this festival called the Airwaves Festival. So I've been over there and gone whale watching and watched my favourite bands like BC Camplight, stuff like that.
You can't beat a mix of music and wildlife. And I tell you, one of the things that always interests me is how places evolve as their popularity grows. Have you found that with Iceland?
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I mean, it's changed quite a lot. Every time I would go, it became more touristy. And the last time that we went there, the prices were exorbitant. So, of course, there was a financial crisis a few years ago. And the only way that I, probably like you, Kerry, the best way to judge the economy of a certain country is how much you pay for a pint. And I remember going with Mark Carwardine, and I think a pint of Guinness was around about, yeah, maybe £8 or something like that. We went another time and it was around about £4 because the economy had crashed. The last time we went, I think it was like £16 for a pint. I don't know what it is at the moment, but it's and there's a massive, the last time I was there a couple of years ago, a massive crater right in the middle of Reykjavik. Now, this isn't a volcanic crater. It's a man-made crater where they'd knocked a load of different businesses down and they were building the mother of all hotels. And it's kind of because Iceland is on the top of most people's bucket list, you know, because it's an amazing place. We went there. I went there with Jimmy Goodwin, our mutual friend, and some Icelandic mates, and we went down a volcano, and a dead volcano, obviously inactive. But at that point in time, more people had been in space than had been down a volcano. It was a really ridiculous thing to do, and exciting and fantastic, and as it turns out, slightly dangerous, and they shut the operation down not long after we'd done it. So I have got some photographs of us down inside this volcano. But you've got that, you've got the geysers, you've got the waterfalls, you've got the whales and other cetaceans. And there's an amazing... We did a trip up the fault line right to the north to a place called Húsavík. And thankfully, there's no whaling up at that neck of Iceland, as I understand it. And we saw a lot more whales. And I think that the whale watching from Reykjavik did become a little bit too kind of, fragile is one word for it, because obviously they were the waters that they were hunting the whales in. And there's even a story, and it's not apocryphal, I know it to be true, that there was a boat out one day watching a minke whale and one of the gunboats came up beside it and harpooned it. So I think I would have been doing like, you know, I would have been hopping over the side with a knife in my mouth, swinging from the yard arm or whatever you call it, if I'd have been on that boat. I just can't imagine what that must have been like for the people who were out there whale watching. It's always had that kind of dual purpose. You've got this really great loads and loads of Icelandic people. The Icelandic people don't eat whale meats. Some of the older generation do, but most of the kids coming through abhor whaling and they don't eat whale meat. Most of the whale meat that gets sold in Iceland is to idiot tourists who go whale watching one day and then eat a whale the next. You know, it's kind of like, it's just beggars belief, really.
But it all beggars belief, doesn't it, Mark? I don't understand how it even exists in the modern world. They talk about tradition, but surely traditions can change, have to change, must change. We've got to get rid of it.
Well, there was a lot of money to be made. I mean, the Onassis dynasty made their money, most of it, as I understand it, in the whaling industry. And it was the Onassis family that sold their whaling fleet when the civilized world stopped whaling and it was becoming, you know, and they were becoming protected and Save the Whale was getting some momentum and all that kind of stuff. I believe he sold his whaling fleet to the Japanese, who of course have been the most vociferous whalers of all. And even to the point of them dropping out of the moratorium and saying, right, okay, if you want us to stop whaling, we're just going to leave, which everybody was always really fearful of. And that's exactly what happened, you know. So they're saying you can't kill these whales. You can take so many minke whales. You can take a couple of fin whales and this, that, don't touch blue whales and blah, blah, blah. And for years and years, they fought and fought. And until it came to the point where they just said, right, okay, well, we're not part of this club anymore. We'll do what we like, you know. And I know that the guy who runs the Icelandic whaling setup once said that, I believe this to be true, that he would even just continue killing whales, even if only to get the oil to run the boats to go whaling, you know. So it's a bloody business. It's a bloody-minded business as well. And I'm just, I'm just hoping that it's not long for this world. The Norwegians do it as well, obviously, you know. So, yeah, it's pretty sickening, really.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. Interestingly, I saw a film on the IFAW website. That's the International Fund for Animal Welfare. And the film was called The Sonic Sea. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no.
It's amazing. It's about how sound, such as sonar and sea traffic, affects sea creatures. It stops their communications and disrupts their ability to hunt. If people haven't seen it, I urge you to check it out at IFAW.org.
Yeah, well, that's a great call, and I will do that, Kerry. I mean, the sonar thing is, it's just awful. They reckon that that is responsible for a lot of the strandings that take place, you know, and people don't really know that for sure, but I don't think it's a coincidence that where a lot of military action takes place, there are a lot of strandings, you know. And there was also that thing not so long ago where this whale was called the loneliest whale in the world, because I think it was a hybrid. It might have been a fin whale crossed with a blue whale, which is ultra rare. But it's got this unique call, and they recognise it as a unique call. I mean, I know that all of the whales have got different, different accents and all those weird kind of things, but this was called the loneliest whale in the world, and it was thought that it wouldn't ever be able to find a mate, which is, a tragic story in itself.
That story reminds me about Martha, the last passenger pigeon, who died in, I think it was 1914, in Cincinnati Zoo. And they reckon she was about 29 years of age, and she'd lived in the zoo for years. And sadly, they never found anyone else to mate with her. And that was the end of a species. Right, well, I think we've got to the end of that subject. So let's move on. Tell me, how did you end up going to Norway?
Well, Mark Harwardine just got in touch with me and said, do you want to come to Norway and swim with killer whales? So, and again, I didn't know too much about it at that point in time. And so I was naturally a little bit like, really? Is this a thing? And he's going, yeah, no, nobody's ever been killed by an orca. And this is a trip that we run maybe every year, I can't remember. So I was like, yeah, I'm in. And so I remember we met in London, and then we flew to one airport in Norway and then took another flight. And then we needed basically just to have a quick flit across one of the fjords, but the ferries weren't running at that time of night. And so we had this drive through a blizzard, and the drive took about 4.5 hours. Now, I'm not the sharpest tool in the box, and so I wasn't thinking about the geography of it. And so naturally, if you're in on the land within a fjord, you're travelling inland and then travelling back out again. If you're going to go as the crow flies or as the ferry sails, it will take you half an hour, but you can't do it because there's no ferry at that point in time. So we were just driving through the driving snow. And I remember thinking, God, we're going to a new frontier here. I'm going to get a flag and stick it in the ground. And after we'd been driving for about 3 hours, we passed this little bungalow. And I remember this old lady looking out of the window and drawing the curtains. And I felt so crestfallen because I thought I was this brave new, adventurer. But no, this was just people's normal life. And so we eventually got there to a place called Tisford, which is probably not pronounced that way. And the first day, I remember, we went out on a rib, and we went to where, actually, there were some fishing boats there, and the orca did used to follow them, because obviously the fishermen know where the herring are, or were, and so the orca would be in the same place. And so we went and saw orcas just all around us. It was mind-blowing. And the next day, we went out the first day was on a bigger boat, and then the second day was on the rib, and that's when we got up at the crack of dawn and we put dry suits on and went out on a rib, probably around about 10 of us on each rib, probably 3 ribs. And yeah, you get in amongst the orca and just dive in or roll in. And the amazing thing was that I got in the water and I looked down, and I was just on top of this massive bait ball. So it must have been at 30 feet in diameter, and I thought, God, if there's a bait ball here, something has put these fish into this ball. And I looked to my right, and it was only about 25 feet away, was an orca, and it was vertical, and it was about to slap the ball with its tail, which is what they do. They slap the tail. They just daze some of them with the actual action, but also the sound wave that it creates stuns a lot of the fish. And then they just go along gently, eating them one by one. There's none of this lunge feeding like the great whales do. And so I looked down, and a whale just about to send its tail flashing right in my direction, which was quite terrifying, but it stopped. And it went down, came round again, and I moved further away, and then it did it. And all I do remember, it was weird, because obviously we were in the snow-capped mountains around us, and it was snow everywhere. Under the water, it was just like a snowstorm, but it was scales from the fish that had been hit and shocked by this action of the orca. And so, yeah, we were just in and amongst the orca, probably in there for about half an hour or so. It's probably the most exciting thing I'll ever do in my life. I have swum with basking sharks and dolphins, but and the basking shark thing is quite incredible, as you know, and we'll probably talk about that in a moment. But getting in the water with orca is, yeah, for me, it was just mind-blowing. And I doubt I'll ever do anything more thrilling than that, probably, in a wildlife scenario anyway.
Well, I think you're correct. I think when you have these chance encounters, and as you said earlier, you've either got an appointment with a creature or you haven't, and there's something almost spiritual. And I don't mean this in the religious kind of way, but there is a connection that happens when you meet wildlife on its own terms. And you know that in a moment, in a flash, if the orca's tail had been at the wrong direction, you're gone. And it probably won't even notice what's happened to you. And you suddenly feel that smallness of life, your own insignificance. It's like being outside under a canopy of stars. It's that feeling of, I don't know, that you belong, but you don't feel important anymore. And I think this is what the natural world around us can do, strip away man's arrogance and give us a sense of place and worth. And as for mental health, nature gives a sense of belonging in a way I'm not sure that we find just being amongst ourselves. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, I'll tell you, Gary, I mean, it's something that struck me not so long ago, but I'm sure that, you know, in however many years' time, there will be a study and they will come up with the fact that humans are split into two different species. And we aren't all actually the same, because there are, you know, there are people who have real empathy, like your, what the situations you're talking about, and how you go and you see a whale right beside you. I went to St. Ignacio Lagoon off Mexico, Baja, and you go on these little boats, you go in on your own boat, and then you get on a smaller boat, and you go out to where the grey whales are and the calves. And the experience I had was incredible. So there's a grey whale with its calf, and the grey whale pushed its calf to the boat, and it put its head on the boat. It sounds ridiculous, but that's what they were doing. You know, I mean, and so you've got that going on. You've also got nature, the other end of it. So it's well known that the entrance to the lagoon, orca wait for them to come out so they can kill the calves and eat them. They only eat the tongues, actually, I think. So you've got this really beautiful scenario going on, but then you've got the whales themselves having to negotiate the way out of the lagoon and then go off on their travels up north. But it is humbling. So in one part of the world, you might get a large community of people who find however many pilot whales, it seems to be pilot whales, generally speaking, who knows why, but a mass stranding of pilot whales. And people will be really upset by this, and they will go down there, and they will get wet towels and put them on so they don't get sunburned, and they're keeping hydrated and all that kind of stuff. And they will try and float them back out to sea, and they will become devastated if they don't succeed. Whereas in another part of the world, the Faroe Islands, for instance, they've got this thing called a grind, where they go out and drag, they herd the pilot whales into the bay and then drag them out onto the beach with hooks and kill them. How can the same species have such very, very different attitudes towards wildlife you know, you can get too deep and too spiritual about it, to each other, of course. But it just, I really cannot work out how people can be so different, how one set of people can get enjoyment out of doing it, whereas other people will be completely devastated by it. It's some kind of weird empathy thing which is missing from certain parts of humanity, and it's a pretty heavy thing, but it's got to be right. How, you know, something that really upsets one person is a good day out for another, and that is just, I really find that perplexing. And I'm not going to take the moral high ground and say who's doing what is right or wrong. I'm just saying it's very, very different.
I would agree with you.
And actually, of course, you could say exactly the same thing about the UK. I mean, if I was to see a pack of dogs tearing apart a fox, I would be severely distressed. But for others, that is a good day out.
Let's move on to the island of Mull. We've been there a couple of times together, and the first time we went with our group of friends and nature lovers, commonly known as the F-wits. We won't even discuss that, but I think you get the idea. So much happened on that trip. We saw sea eagles, hooked up with British Sea Power, and didn't we rescue a car?
Oh, yeah, we did. Of course we did, yeah. No, there was a woman had reversed a car over this little bridge and it was hanging off. It was teetering over the edge. And so, Yeah, there was about six of us. And so we got out and we picked the car up and put it back in its right position. And the woman in the car and the people in the house next to where it all happened who knew her, they were just clapping us. And I just remember Jimmy Goodwin, when we all got back in, and she was saying, "I can't thank you enough." And Jimmy just put one foot on the inside the minibus that we were in. He went, "You've not seen us, okay?" So it's some kind of line out the A-team or something, you know, like we just go around sort of helping people out of terrible predicaments. But the first time I went to Mull, it was strange because we did see whales, we saw dolphins, we saw the eagles, and also we were walking down the road and a slow worm fell out of the sky. And I was like, what is this place? This is the most remarkable place on earth. And it was just so sunny. It was like a heat wave. And it turns out, I mean, I didn't know. I had a slow worm when I was a youngster, but I didn't realise that they can let off a noxious smell like a skunk if they get attacked. And so what had obviously happened was a bird of prey had taken it. It had, I imagine, let off this noxious gas, and the bird had dropped it. And I came to that conclusion because it had a lot of talon punctures in its body, and it wasn't well. Put it that way. But you know, that you look at Mull and you think, God, this is something else. The next time we went out whale watching, didn't see anything, and it poured down from start to finish. So we had the two extremes, you know.
You and I also went with Damon Albarn to Mull for a Radio 4 documentary you were making. That was superb, as we all went swimming with seals, and then you two went swimming with basking sharks. Happily, I stayed on the boat and I commentated on all your exploits out in the deep waters. Oh, it makes me shiver just thinking about it. I mean, I look at the photos of the two of you, little tiny specks next to these gigantic fins sticking out of the water. And I remember your faces when you came back on board. Pure joy.
Yeah, it was second only to swimming with the orca because they're just so prehistoric. I mean, orca are great. They're cool, you know. They look cool. The way they swim is cool. Basking sharks, obviously, they look like dinosaurs. The skin, if you touch the skin, which we didn't, though we got pretty damn close. We were probably only around about, I don't know, maybe 8 feet away from three 27-foot sharks that swam past us. But the skin is like sandpaper. If you rub it the wrong way, it will cut your skin open. And we had to chase them about a bit, you know, not harassing them, but they go their own way. They're that big, they don't care about anything. And that's why they came so close to us. They weren't scared of us in any way, shape or form. And of course, for those who don't know, basking sharks just have the tiniest teeth. They're plankton feeders. And so they are the ones, again, I don't want to patronise you, but if you don't know, they famously just swim around with a mouth gaping open. And it's a mouth that would be big enough to swallow a human. And yeah, we saw them swimming away from us, and then we got in the boat and then moved along a little bit. Then we got back in and we're swimming and they're going away. Then all of a sudden, all three of them just decide to turn round, just sweep round, because they're not going anywhere. They're just trying to find the plankton. So they're just like chancing their arms. Well, they haven't got arms, but you know what I mean. And so they just turned round and then straight towards us and straight past us. And it was... yeah, it was just a real moment, something else. I mean, I do remember, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, but Damon was a little bit reticent. He's saying, you know, what if they, like, attack us? No, they don't attack, and it's never happened, and they haven't got any teeth. Well, what if they eat you with the tail? Yeah, that'd hurt, but I've never heard of that either. I do remember Damon at the end of it all just saying it was one of the best weekends of his life, and let's face it, Damon lives a life. So of the simple things, you know, it's all right. I mean, he does Africa Express, and he does all these amazing things, and he goes all around the world getting looked after and being adored. But, you know, in his bobble hat and shorts and, you know, a snorkel in the middle of the sea off the coast of Mull, then that was a special, real special moment for Damon as well. So, and how could it not be? And in fact, I loved it so much, I went back the following year with some mates and we didn't see any sharks. So, again, it was a massive effort to... you said, Neffert. I mean, you end up in Mull, so it's just one of the best places in the world. But, yeah, the bottom line is that we went all that way to swim with sharks, and the sharks had other ideas.
They did, and you can only imagine what the record company thought of it.
They would have looked for the clause in the insurance, I would imagine, but, they're just so beautiful and graceful and gentle. They are the cliche of the gentle giant. That's the basking shark. Amazing creatures.
That they are. We're talking about strange and magical encounters. But where's the oddest place you've been to see nature?
We did go... I'm sure the kids would rather have gone to Disney World. But we eventually decided to go to the Azores, or the Azores, if you like. And so we went to Portugal, we went to Lisbon for a few days, and then we went over to the Azores. Now, I'd run this past Mark Carwardine, and it's that sperm whales are synonymous with the Azores. And so it looked idyllic, it looked really beautiful and everything. But Mark Carwardine did say to me, he said, there's nothing to do there. Apart from going whale watching, there's just really nothing. It's just, honestly. And so I didn't take any notice of him. I think Trace would say, no, it looks great. I'm sure it'll be fine, you know. So we went, and there was nothing to do there. I mean, we did see sperm whale, and I saw a sperm whale breach as well, which is really unusual. I've seen all manner of other whales breaching, but never a sperm whale. So, and it was great, but the actual trip was quite brutal on a rib. It was really a rough ride. The weather was beautiful, but it was a really rough ride. It was one of those when you go up on the rib and you come back down and hit the water, and it's like you're hitting concrete. And I do remember, it's funny because I had the pop group live in session a few years ago, and I was talking to Mark Stewart. He's a brilliant guy, such a clever, brilliant guy. And he lived in the Azores on a side of a mountain for a year or so, which is pretty bohemian. But if you knew Mark Stewart, you could place him there. And there aren't many people I could say that about, really, to be honest. So... the whale watching was great, but I wouldn't recommend it as a family holiday, put it that way.
And there's another thing. You go whale watching with your wife, Trace. Is it more special that you share this pastime together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's two aspects to this answer, really. And the other is that I remember I was going to go and see City v Gillingham in the legendary playoffs from the second division of old. And... my dad said to me, what time are we leaving, son? I said, oh, we'll be leaving at 7 in the morning. It was a coach, corporate kind of do. He went, all right, what time do we get back? I said, it'll be about midnight. And he went, oh, he was in his 60s. He said, I can't do it, son. It's just too long a day. So I was like, fine, dad, that's no bother. All my mates were going, my City supporting mates were going already. So I came home and said to Trace, you're coming to Wembley with me. She had no interest in football whatsoever. The only time she took any interest was when I'd come home from a match and she'd go, have you lost again? So, and I went home and I just said, you're coming to Wembley with me? She went, what? I said, look, it'll be a spectacle. Wembley is being shut down, being demolished. It'll be an exciting match. It's a corporate thing. We'll meet some good people. We'll have some food and a drink. And you're coming with me. I'm not going on my own because my mates are already sat elsewhere. And so... she came to the match, and at the end of it, the most amazing, probably the most important match City have ever had, to be honest, because if we didn't win that day, then we certainly wouldn't be where we are now. And at the end of it, she just was exhausted, and she said, I'm in, get me a season ticket. And so that, and the fact that when we went out watching whales, the pilot whales in Tenerife, and then the humpbacks in off Cape Cod, yeah, she absolutely loved it. And she loves the wildlife. She was into bird watching and everything when she was a teenager. And so, yeah, I mean, she's my soulmate anyway, you know. But, yeah, that is great. I can go and want to do wildlifey things. And Trace won't be, like, skulking behind me with a long face. She'll be there right alongside me with the binoculars on, you know. So I'm very lucky in that respect.
You really are. I wanted to ask you, is there a particular whale you want to see, as they've just recorded a new species, which they thought was a bride's whale? Is that correct?
It is, yeah. Though I did mention this to you before, mate, but I didn't tell you how to pronounce it. And in all honesty, I'm probably going to get it wrong myself, but everybody calls it a bride's whale, which is fine enough. It's B-R-Y-D-E-S. So that is exactly what you would expect. But apparently, it's not brides, it's brooders. And it is the Norwegian name of the guy who discovered it in the first place. And so it's a brooder's whale. And so I remember when we were in Tenerife, probably about 5 years ago now, and we were staying in a place called Los Gigantes, and it was June, and they'd been seen. It had all the board outside spotted yesterday, bottlenose dolphins, brooder's whales. And so I went in and said, oh, have you seen anything this morning? She went, oh, yeah, bride's whales. I'm going, oh, right, okay, we'll book. We went out on this boat. There was only me and Trace and the couple who ran this little rib. It was fantastic. It was a really fast boat. So we just got out to where they'd been seen last. And immediately they come up and they're going, oh, there they are. I'm going, oh, God, that's great. You know, we normally just see pilot whales and dolphins around here. But, yeah, a brooder's whale. And he went, a bride's whale. I'm going, oh, no, sorry, mate. It's actually brooders. It was Mark Carwardian who told me this. So if I'm wrong, you can blame him. But it is a brooder's whale. And so even the tour operators call it a bride's whale. So, I mean, you can forgive yourself on this particular occasion, mate. But, yeah, a new species. I mean, so many people have probably seen it. Mark Carwardian has probably seen it 100 times because he goes to Baja, California twice a year or did. So it's very similar to a brooder's whale, and it's a new species. When I went to Baja, California with Mark Carwardian, when was that? I think I've got it written down here somewhere. 2009, was it maybe? But anyway, it was 2009. We had one first day travelling from San Diego south, and the rolling into the second day, they said this is where the two different currents meet, and it's really rough. And it was, God, it was so rough. I felt that bad. I've done a lot of time on boats, but it felt that bad. If I could have had a helicopter come and airlift me off, I would have taken it, even though I knew everything that was going to come in the ensuing days. But anyway, I got through it. And then, so you get up on the third day, and Mark Carwardian would say, right, today we're going to see humpback whales. Right, okay, Mark, you go out, keep going, humpback whale. Wow, great, good call, Mark. Next day, today we're going to be seeing sperm whales. Yeah, of course we are, Mark. 3 hours later, surrounded by sperm whales. The next day, right, this is blue whale day. Yeah, okay, go out, next minute, blue whales. So, and of course, I mean, the whole prediction wasn't random or very lucky. It was due to the fact that the conditions that you were in at that particular part of the sea led to the inclusion of certain species. So if it's a really dark kind of canyon down below, then it would be sperm whale because they can go deeper than any others, and that's where the squid would be, and it'd be another certain area where the population of local fish is suited to the diet of the blue whale. So it all made sense, but he just predicted it day in, day out. On that trip alone, I saw all of the great whales apart from, which you wouldn't see, a bowhead. So I've seen blue whales, I've seen fin, humpback, grey whales, minke whales, I've seen all of the whales that I wanted to see. The only ones that I haven't seen really is a bowhead, which would be incredible. But I've never seen a narwhal or a beluga, and I would very much like to see both of those species or all three of those species. But yeah, I have seen Cuvier's beaked whales and Sowerby's beaked whales, and so I've seen pretty much everything there is to see in the whale community. So I mean I've done it enough, you know. I've put the time in, and I've obviously been on lots of trips where I've seen nothing. The tick list is pretty healthy anyway, put it that way.
We're just about out of time now, Mark. So thank you so much for being our guest. I'd just like to ask, is there anything you want to add before we go?
It's an absolute pleasure, Kerry, always. And I would add at this point in time, if you live in the UK and you want to go whale watching, but you don't want to travel perhaps too far, I would really recommend West Cork. It's just amazing. So when I was going there originally, around about probably 15 years ago, you would get a lot of minke whales and you would get fin whales, which is incredible. Fin whales are the second biggest whale species. But of late, there was always one humpback whale that came back every year. And because it kept coming back, they called it boomerang. But now, I'm presuming because they aren't killing so many of them and the numbers are growing slightly, they get a good population of humpback whales out there as well. And in fact, Colin Barnes, who runs a Holly Joe whale watching West Cork, he's got two photographs in his cabin of a blue whale. It's the same blue whale. It was so big, he had to take a photograph and then move the camera and take the photograph of the other part of the body. And he's, I think he's only ever seen one blue whale there, but that is quite mind-blowing. And maybe it was lost. But anyway, I would recommend Baltimore as a great place to go. And it's just such a great, brilliant little village as well.
Well, I'll tell you, this has given me an idea. I think I'm going to get planning our next F-Wit adventure because my wife Jackie's family all live down in Skull and Cape Clear, which is only around the corner from Baltimore. So maybe we need to get down to that wonderful part of the world. I love it. What an idea. What do you think? Is it a goer?
It's a goer.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, until next time, this has been a Gonservation Conversation with Mark Riley, a true Gonservationist. Gonservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Lyrics by me. Find out more about Gonservation and Gonservation Conversations at gonservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at Gonservation. Gonservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.